And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Like so many other millions of people across America, I can't wait to get out this weekend and have a great time. I'm headed to the lake with my lady and some friends, and yep, we're firing up the Barbie, throwing on some weenies, and taking some time to just enjoy life. And in that spirit, we bring you this special 4th of July edition of the Wildside News. Coming up, we're going to see how to make your holiday photos better. Take a look at how you can help your animal friends celebrate in a safe and unthreatening way, and then take an in-depth look at America's future. When we return to your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I'll bet a lot of you are looking forward to this 4th of July weekend. I tell you what, I sure know I am. I love bringing you the Wildside News each week. I almost have no choice but to do this because I'm so enamored with the wonders of our planet, and right now, we face some levels of challenge that perhaps humanity has never faced before. And through the miracles of internet media, we can share this around the world. But you know what? We all need to take time off, to let go of our concerns and give in to fun and good times. So that's pretty much what we're going to do today. And in this spirit, I'm even going to forego the news as we talk in depth in our third segment with Jim DePeso, Policy Director for REP, Republicans for Environmental Protection, about the newly passed Senate Energy Bill. That will definitely bring us up to date on events happening in that arena. But it's time to lighten up, and so we will. In a moment, we talk with David Kastnoff, who joins us from New York from the Kodak headquarters. David is going to give you some great tips on how to make those outdoor photographs even better. And in our second segment, you know, the 4th of July is one of the world's great celebrations. Every single city, town, and backyard will express their spirit of freedom with fireworks, firecrackers, and sparklers. It's a terrific time, if you're human. But for most of our animal friends, our pets and neighborhood animals, the 4th is probably one of the scariest days of their lives. To help you make sure you've given your beloved pets a fair shake in all this, we talk with Dr. Mark Goldstein, who is a vet and president of the San Diego Humane Society, about what we really need to do for our animal friends. Now, this is a segment that will be great for anyone with a pet to listen to, and that includes every kid you can think of, because they will benefit from this sensitive discussion. So make the effort to round up a kid or two and share segment two. Your pet will be glad you did. So let's get this celebration started. I wish you all a fun-filled and safe 4th of July. Well, I'm really happy to have as a guest now on the Wildside News, David Kastnoff, who works with Kodak. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Dave, you know, the 4th of July is coming up, and a lot, literally millions of people are going to be heading out very often to parks and national parks and rivers and lakes and things like that. Many of those people love to record those moments photographically. Why don't you talk about the trends in photography? Are more and more people using photographs now and cameras with the digital, or what is the trend line on that?
Well, we're finding that consumers in the United States and globally are really captivated by digital photography. It's incredibly easy to use. It creates generally a lot of sharing of pictures, and a lot of consumers find it much easier to print the pictures they really want, whether they do it at home, online, or at a retail store. And even in the event that digital is becoming more popular, there's still a segment of the audience and consumers that finds that their film camera really gives them a terrific value because it's so easy to use. With a film camera, you don't need to use a computer. you take your photographs, you drop your film off, you come back, you get your film negatives, you get your prints, and in many cases you can have your pictures digitized to a Kodak Picture CD or similar product, and if you want to have them in electronic form, in digital form, you can take that CD home, pop it in your computer, and email your pictures much the same way you could with a picture that originated in a digital camera.
It's a terrific crossover that's happening between the film and video. It's a wonderful opportunity to kind of do whatever you want to do these days. But, you know, nevertheless, whether you're shooting with digital or with film, still there are principles of taking better photographs. I know Kodak has lots of terrific information and advice on that. Let's hear some ideas on how people, as they head out, can create better photographs.
Well, what we generally tell people, the most important thing to do is to keep it simple. And if you either haven't used your camera in a while, or even if you're an avid photographer, one of the smartest things to do is first check and make sure your camera has fresh batteries. Almost all cameras use batteries now. You know, make sure the lens is clean, there's no dust on it, and you know, just make sure everything works perfectly before they go on a vacation. We advise them to shoot a couple of pictures, finish off a roll that may still be in their camera, or shoot a couple of digital pictures, and then go over to the store, print them, make sure that the results are consistent with your expectations. The next thing to do, just in terms of taking good pictures, is to focus on one main idea or one main subject in a photo, whether it's family members, whether it's a scenic view of the Grand Canyon, whether it's a lighthouse on the shore of Maine, whatever it is, not to try and clutter the picture. And the easiest way to prevent cluttering a picture is to get closer to your subject. Really have it fill the frame. Now, zoom cameras make that easy, but a much simpler way to zoom and to get better pictures is to zoom with your feet. Take an extra step closer to your subject, and what that does is it removes a lot of background clutter from your photograph. And another thing we tell people, particularly because the vast majority of vacation photos in the summertime are taken outdoors during the day, we tell people to use the flash on their cameras even if it's bright sun out, because what most people don't necessarily have an awareness of is the fact that at midday, the sun being right overhead, it creates this glare and shadow on the faces of your subjects. And if you use the on-camera flash, that helps eliminate the glare and the dark circles under the eyes that are just a function of having the sun come from straight overhead. Now, experienced photographers will tell you the best time to shoot really rich, colorful photos is at the beginning of the day before the sun is high in the sky, or very late in the day, just around the time the sun is going down, because then the sun's at a low angle, you get these very nice shadows, you get a lot of contrast, and the photos are much more scenic and similar to what you would see on postcards.
Here's a question that I would have, because I don't really have an answer to this. So I'm taking a picture, let's say, of three of my friends out on the lake, and they're having some fun. Is it better to take a full-body shot or perhaps pull in a little closer?
You know, most people do try and do the full body, and I know, for example, my feet aren't terribly attractive, and you don't need to show them in photographs. Usually, for most people, head and shoulders is fine, unless they're wearing a very unusually colored bathing suit and you want to capture that. I encourage people to move in close enough so that you crop them at waist level. It's more flattering. It emphasizes the face and the eyes, and that's what most people want to see in a portrait or a candid shot of people is the face and the eyes.
Now, what about the position of the person in relationship to the sun? In other words, should they be facing the sun, or should they possibly be in more at an angle to the sun? What is your recommendation?
Again, generally, putting the sun off to one side or slightly behind your shoulders makes for a more flattering photo. The problem is if the sun is directly behind the photographer and someone is looking at the photographer, they're going to squint. They're going to scrunch up their face. The photo won't be nearly as flattering. So the advantage of having side light or sunlight at an angle is that it can create a little bit of shadow and a little bit of depth perception and character in the photo of a person or of an object. And it's that, you know, people think that photography is all about capturing light, but it's also about capturing you know, shadows and the subtle details in the light and darkness.
There's some interesting concepts in terms of composition, the one-third, two-third, that a lot of Kodak photographers talk about. How can you make that easy for us to understand?
Well, you know, in some cases there are digital cameras that you can press the display button on the camera and it'll put what looks like a small tic-tac-toe board over the LCD, the screen on the back of your camera. That's called the rule of thirds, and what it does is it helps you compose the picture instead of having your subject right smack in the center of the photo. What professional photographers very often do is compose their photos so that if it's a person or an object, it is at the intersection of one of those crosshairs, the up and down and the sideways of that imaginary tic-tac-toe board. If your camera doesn't have that, just sort of envision that when you look in the viewfinder and try and compose your subject in one of those intersections of the tic-tac-toe board, and what you find is you've got a photo that balances both the subject of the photo and some of the background detail. It's much more intriguing than what we would tend to think of as a mugshot, where the person or the object is right dead center of the photo.
Many people are going to experience wildlife. What are some thoughts in terms of, you know, when you come across animals, what should people think about?
Well, the first thing they should think about is their own safety. They shouldn't take unnecessary risks in trying to get too close to a wild animal. You don't know whether the wild animal is hunting or whether it's injured and therefore feels it needs to defend itself. Now, the great thing is there are a number of digital cameras out on the market today, including the EasyShare, the Kodak EasyShare DX7590. They have 10x optical zoom. It can bring you 10 times closer. This camera and similar ones from other manufacturers can really get you close to your subject without getting in a risky situation. The nice thing about these cameras is many of them have excellent control over shutter speed and aperture, or you can leave them on auto and they'll still take a good picture. There isn't the click typically of a mechanical shutter as you have with a film camera, so it is less obtrusive and less distracting to the wild animal.
One of the differences, the obvious differences between the film and the digital that a lot of people find a little confusing and frustrating, you know, with standard film cameras, typically when you click at that moment, you got a shot. With the digital, there oftentimes is a delay, and sometimes literally it takes a while for that image to mature. That can be difficult, and the person takes a shot, they look and they find out that it's blurred, it isn't clear. How can they help that?
Well, you know, every digital camera, and I mean every digital camera, does something called pre-focus, and it is so easy to get a near instantaneous working of the shutter button. If you compose your picture and then you just half press the shutter button, what that does is it locks the exposure, it locks the focus, and then once you've got that, and there's usually a little confirmation on the screen or in the viewfinder, light goes on, then push it the rest of the way and the shutter trips instantaneously. It's 1/10 of a second. Most people are accustomed to pushing a shutter on a mechanical shutter button on a camera. And what they don't realize is the cameras that did that did not have a little computer chip inside that measured the light, measured the aperture, chose the shutter speed, decided whether the color balance was correct. And digital cameras do all that, and it's a computation that takes a fraction of a second. But if consumers got in the habit of sort of pre-focusing the camera, pushing that shutter button down halfway, and then once they've got the photo they want composed, push it the rest of the way, they would get a better composed photo. They'd get the photo that they intended to shoot.
Certainly, if people get out and really practice before they head out and want to take some serious shots, then really learn their camera, because the differences in digital cameras and how they operate are quite significant, really.
Well, pretty much. And, you know, I've seen this myself. I've seen people come to the airport going on vacation, and they're taking the camera out of the package while they're in the terminal.
Right.
They haven't. And frankly, it puts them in an awkward situation. Very often, the battery needs to charge for a few hours before you first use it, which means you're going to not be able to use the camera until you get to your hotel and have a chance to charge it, or your campground and hope there's a place to charge it. They really should take the camera, and even if it's late afternoon or early evening, get it home, charge the battery, go out and take pictures of everyday things just around their street. I mean, the great thing about digital is you don't want to keep the photo forever. You can delete it. This way you get comfortable with using it. You say, oh, okay, it does this. It takes this much time to extend the lens from 1x to 10x. And you get more of an appreciation for how the camera works. Now, truth be known, many digital cameras operate in a similar fashion. They all use an autofocus system. Some have manual override, but the vast majority use autofocus. They all have that pre-focus. They all have a flash that you can set to fire all the time, or not fire, or only fire for red eye effect. A lot of the features on digital cameras are similar. The one thing that's very unique about the Kodak EasyShare system is that our cameras have a share button on the back of them. So if you get a photo that you think is really extraordinary, you can push that little red share button on the back of the camera, and it tags the picture so that later on when you're downloading the pictures into your computer, the software that came with the camera that you can install on your computer will ask, okay, who did you want to share this with? Or, this is the picture you tagged for sharing. Do you want to email it here? Do you want to upload it to the Kodak EasyShare gallery online to print? And it sort of leaves a mental footnote or a digital footnote tagged to that particular image.
I've heard of the EasyShare. Now I understand what that's about.
Well, one of the things we wanted to do with EasyShare, the whole point of it was that people found digital cameras a little bit daunting because at the time that they became very, very popular, film cameras were still widely used, and people didn't know how to get the digital pictures out of the camera. They would fill a memory card and go, what do I do with this now? Because it's not a roll of film. You could take it to the store and they would print from it, but you could share. So one of the things we came up with was the EasyShare camera dock, which allowed you to put the camera down on this little dock. It was wired with a USB cable to your computer. You press the little button on the dock, the camera automatically downloaded the pictures into your computer. It brought up little thumbnail displays. It emptied the memory card, and oh, by the way, while that was going on, your camera battery was being recharged. So the whole idea of making it easier to share the pictures and get them out of your camera and do more with them was the thinking behind the Kodak EasyShare system.
EasyShare. It makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
No, it really makes sense. That's a great concept. I know that very often it's easy to fill up a card, and quite honestly, card management, in other words, the digital cards that you're saving these things on, is an important part of really enjoying the photographic experience, because if you just clutter up your card with photographs, every time you go and look at that card, you've got to go through all these things to try to figure out what's the most current, most interesting photograph. How about digital editing? Give us some advice about that.
Well, The nice thing about digital photography is it lets you manipulate your photos a countless number of ways. And you don't need to, you can spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on professional digital editing software, or you can use free software. When you buy a Kodak EasyShare camera, or when you get your film pictures placed on a Kodak picture CD in digital format, both of those products come with the latest version of Kodak EasyShare software.
Hmm.
And this software lets you do minor editing and some very creative things. It lets you lighten your photos. It lets you change the contrast. It lets you do a little bit of sharpening so that if something is not quite in focus, you can digitally enhance it. It lets you do some wild things, turn your photos to black and white or sepia tone. You can create an artificial fisheye look in your digital pictures. And you can download the EasyShare software for free from our website, www.kodak.com. And like I say, EasyShare comes at no charge. The nice thing about it is it lets you play with your pictures. And they don't sit in a shoebox and gather dust. You can do more with them. And from EasyShare software, you can email them. And you can order prints from the Kodak EasyShare gallery online, all from that software. So it's a great tool for doing more with your photographs. The one thing I caution people to do is to remember, what the subject of the photograph is and not over-correct or overplay with the photo. It's fun, you can have fun and do a fisheye type photo of your son or daughter, but you know, remember, it's a photo of your son and daughter. If you want to keep it, you know, don't overcorrect it. A lot of people, very common practice, because some of the software lets you do it so easily, is to over-sharpen photos. And in doing that, sometimes it creates very ghastly-looking halos around people, and they almost look otherworldly. And very often with digital image editing, what I tell them is less is more. Do less tinkering with it than you think you want to, and the photo will be very satisfying, and it'll make a nice print.
That's absolutely true. I know that with the digital editing capabilities now, you can do almost anything, but you can also spend a lot of time and end up saying, I should have left it the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Very often, you know, I find that I shoot a lot of events that friends and family take part in, and a lot of them take place indoors in social halls and schools. And you know, schools don't have the best lighting in the world. Schools, you know, they're trying to keep their costs down, so they use fluorescent lights. And historically, fluorescent lights create a rather unpleasant greenish cast in the background. Well, you can adjust that mm-hmm. in EasyShare software and a number of different software packages and sort of make it all pleasant. But remember that what you want to come away with is not so much the background being changed. You want, you know, good skin tones that are identical to the natural skin tones of your subject. Again, that's the point where you can correct the picture to the point where it's really, you know, overcorrected and the skin tones don't look natural.
Also, some advice on how to make sure, now that you've taken all these photographs, and particularly around the 4th of July, some of these cameras are going to be exposed to some pretty high temperatures and sunlight. What should people be concerned about there?
Well, whether it's a film camera or a digital camera, what I urge people to do is, you know, you can go out and buy a very expensive water-resistant camera bag, and there are some excellent ones out there, but they usually say, I have a big camera bag, and if you're at all in an area where you know, there are some unsavory people around, that's sort of an advertisement that says, steal this bag. What I tell people to do is go out and buy a $3.99 cooler bag, the kind of thing you'd carry a lunch in to the beach or to the park. Usually it looks pretty much like a cooler bag, and it doesn't say, I have an expensive camera in here. The nice thing about it is you get some protection from the elements. It's waterproof. It's unobtrusive. Many of them now have a lot of pockets. And there's also, you know, you while you buy it, many of them come with these little freezable, reusable ice packs. And I say, you know, put that little ice pack in a little Ziploc type resealable bag and stick that in your bag with your camera and its film, or with the camera and its memory cards. The cold won't hurt the camera, and the cold actually will help protect the film and keep everything working optimally.
Because if either film or digital cameras get too hot, you lose.
Right.
There it goes.
Well, and you know, frankly, what many people don't always realize is that digital cameras are like carrying around a tiny little computer, and everyone has had the situation sometime in their life where their computer has failed because of excessive heat. Because the fan in the computer wasn't operating properly, and a digital camera will get warm when you use it, because when you draw on its internal battery, it's a little reaction there that creates heat as a byproduct. So those are some easy things to do. The other thing I tell people you can pick these up almost anywhere. Buy a mini tripod. Hmm. Virtually every camera in the world comes with a little tripod socket in the bottom, and you can buy a mini tripod bendable wire legs or even mini retracting legs for really about $5 or less. And that allows you to do two things. It allows you to do photographs without flash, because you can turn the flash off, take longer exposures. If the camera's sitting on a tripod, it's not moving, there's less camera shake, you get a better photo with natural light. The other thing it allows you to do is use the self-timer on the camera and include yourself in some of these pictures. And you don't have to carry a big professional tripod if you have one of these little pocket ones. And, you know, I know people who just keep them in their briefcase.
They're fabulous. 3, 4, 5 inches tall. And
that's all you need.
They work perfectly, stowed on a table or on a car or whatever, yeah.
And if you don't want to use that, a little beanbag will actually provide some stability. Hmm. The whole idea with any kind of photography is to reduce shaking of the camera, and you get sharper photos. And if you have any kind of shake in your hands, using a mini tripod or a beanbag or some other firm support will dramatically improve your photos.
Dave, what's happening at Kodak these days that people are going to find exciting in the years ahead?
Well, our emphasis has been on always, you know, providing great ways to take and share and print photos. One of the things that we're very excited about this fall is the introduction of our Kodak EasyShare 1 digital camera, which will be the first camera to use wireless technology. What that means is you'll be able to take pictures with this camera, and if you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, say one of the, a coffee shop or a library, or even at home if you have a wireless network, you'll be able to beam the pictures, if you will, from the camera into your computer or online to the Kodak EasyShare gallery right from the camera.
That is really, really fun. That's really cool.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about the camera is it will have the largest, one of the largest LCD screens, so even people who, you know, are uncomfortable using the little ones, this will have a 3-inch diagonal screen. It will have 256 megabytes of onboard memory, which means it will be able to hold hundreds of photos right in the camera. The camera will actually, in its own way, be an EasyShare photo album because you'll be able to view them right on that 3-inch screen. And it will, you'll be able to create little albums online and use a little, it actually comes with a tiny little stylus because the screen on the camera is a touch screen. It'll let you say, choose this album.
Wow.
Send these pictures using that touch screen. And the whole idea here is, again, to make sharing pictures and printing pictures simple. One of the fun things about it is you'll be able to walk into a retail store that has a Kodak picture maker kiosk and beam the pictures right from the camera into the kiosk and have them printed.
You could possibly even beam them to your palm or your iPad or something like that as well?
Sure, anything that is Wi-Fi capable. It should be able to interface with, and that camera will be in stores in October.
The one thing I think is interesting that you keep on mentioning is this online gallery. That you mean it's possible to upload photographs to the Kodak gallery and share them with your friends?
Oh, sure. The Kodak EasyShare gallery, it's kodakgallery.com, is a website where you can upload at no cost all your digital pictures and put them in little albums and send notes to people, send little slideshows to people. It's more like an invitation to come view a slideshow of these pictures, and both you and they can order prints and photo gifts and T-shirts and mugs imprinted with photographs and photo books of your vacation online. The storage is limitless. The storage is free.
Wow.
I have a couple of thousand photos on KodakGallery.com. That I'm able to share with anyone with an email address. And it's easy and very convenient. You don't have to, if you don't want to drive to the store, you can do it from the comfort of your living room. And then they'll mail you the photographs.
So this is open to virtually anybody that just wants to use the service?
Anybody.
Why don't you give that website again?
It's www.kodakgallery, all one word, .com.
David Kasnoff with Kodak, I want to thank you so much. You're going to head out and have some fun this weekend?
Oh, you bet. I have some fireworks to photograph and some hot dogs to burn. So I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds like a great weekend. Thanks, David.
You bet, Sydney.
You will notice on today's website the location of 6 national parks where Kodak sponsors the Kodak Ambassadors. When you visit Yellowstone, for example, you'll be able to take photographic walks with the Kodak Ambassador, who will help you make better pictures. Kodak has a long legacy in national parks and continues to show their support through their Kodak Ambassadors program. To find out more, follow the links. While you're heading off to your 4th of July weekend, you'll undoubtedly hear plenty of bangs and booms and fireworks. It's all part of this great American holiday. When we return, we learn how to be sure that with all the celebration, your pets and neighborhood creatures don't suffer unnecessarily. As your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's time to celebrate. The celebration begins days before 4th as the bangs and pops of fireworks get started early. But it's important to remember that dogs' hearing is many times more sensitive than ours, and that loud explosions can truly terrify our best friends, the dogs, cats, birds, and other creatures that show so much love for us. When we return, you'll hear what you should know about animals on the 4th of July and how this day of celebration can be a very terrifying experience for our animal friends. If you or people you know expect to partake in pyrotechnic partying, listen up to your voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News. This next segment is really important for lots of people, particularly young people who like to grab sparklers, firecrackers, and bottle rockets and join in the neighborhood fun. It is fun. But it's very important to know that our best friends, our pets, our cats and dogs, and rabbits and birds can suffer terribly. Now, no one wants to do that to our animals, so please take a few minutes to listen up on how you can keep from making this 4th of July a day of disaster for our pets and neighborhood creatures.
This is a great time of the year in America when we have the opportunity to go out and really celebrate the great freedoms that we have. And, of course, that means the 4th of July. This weekend is going to be filled with people heading out all over out to parks and to national parks and celebrating in their backyards with friends and at the beach and other places. And, of course, a huge part of that celebration in America traditionally has been with all sorts of fireworks, firecrackers and sparklers and all sorts of things. And it certainly is a great moment to witness, and it's fun. But you know, there's another side to this that can be somewhat challenging. And joining us to really give us a real heads up on how we can really take care of our animal friends this weekend, at any time, but particularly over the 4th of July weekend, is Dr. Mark Goldstein, who is the president of the San Diego Humane Society. He's a veterinarian, a practicing veterinarian, but now serving as president. Dr. Goldstein, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hi, Sydney. It's great to be here, and it's great to talk about anything having to do with animals and kids.
Let's just talk a little bit on a personal side here. What is it about animals that has caused you to give your life over to caring for them?
Whoa, I think it's that unconditional love that they give us. I've been in this career, profession, avocation, and love for 25 years now plus, and it's wonderful to work both with animals and people. We call that the human-animal bond, and to see the benefits that not only people bring to animals, but the wonderful joys and love that animals bring into our life.
I think sometimes it's a story that needs to be told and retold all the time. For people who are familiar with animals and have pets, they understand it. Some people don't, and that can lead to some problems because people who aren't familiar with animals may not understand some of the challenges that are faced at a time like this for animals. So let's start out, first of all, by talking about what happens around the 4th of July and why this creates unique challenges for our animal friends.
Well, I think sometimes, and it's an interesting thing you say, Sydney, there's a big word that we called anthropomorphic, but what it really means is we try to give sort of human qualities to our animal friends. And one example of that is we may think that because we enjoy fireworks that they'll enjoy fireworks. And nothing could be further from the truth. When we watch what happens to our dogs and cats and guinea pigs and hamsters and rabbits and even our large animals, a firecracker going off, fireworks, whether it's in the air or on the ground, is an unexpected, not only surprising incident, but very frightening incident to animals. I think the closest I could have, talk to it and something we experience is, we're in bed just about to fall asleep and that big thunderclap goes off outside the window. And I think we can all, identify with how frightening that is. Well, to an animal, just because we know when you light the fuse, there's a big bang afterwards and maybe some colors, to an animal, that's a very, very frightening experience.
Well, animals also have special, unique characters and qualities and abilities that actually adds to this dilemma.
Absolutely. Not necessarily their eyesight in this case, but, their hearing, their ability to hear things is, you know, 10 to 100 times fold, depending on the animal we're talking to, more than ours. So a loud bang to us is a massive explosion to them. And again, when you sort of put that together with not even knowing why it's happening in the first place, it's incredibly frightening.
Right. I don't know that animals really understand the concept of the 4th of July and why we're so happy doing these things.
It's great that you mentioned, Sydney. If you even think about our reactions around fireworks, you know, people get giddy, people get, you know, they start screaming, they're excited. There again, our animal friends who want to be so protective of us do not understand sometimes those displays of sort of fake fear, and they respond with real fear.
Well,
vibrations that are caused by fireworks, by bands, by drums, you know, all of these things. I don't mean to be a Scrooge here. I think they're wonderful. A lot of people get a lot of enjoyment out of it. It symbolizes the, you know, July 4th and the independence and freedom that we enjoy in this country. But I think we have to be sensitive and caring to our animal friends to protect them against not understanding these things.
Do you notice increased incidences of frightened and scared or perhaps even runaway animals over the 4th of July weekend?
You know, you've touched on it, the fear and the scared and the scary behaviors are concerning to us, but the more dramatic issues are the ones you just mentioned. An animal running away and then subsequently getting lost. On an evening, especially when it's very hard to get support services to help find your animals because it is a national holiday, coupled with the fact that some animals, when they're scared, may even injure themselves, running around the house, trying to hide under something, trying to get behind the television and coming in contact with the wires. So what this brings up is maybe a bit of a discussion. What precautions can we take?
Let's do that. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
First, with a new animal in your house, and I hope I don't put a damper on anybody's plans for July 4th, you know, if you've never gone through at least one July 4th with your animal, you may want to stay with them, you know, to just leave them in your house and then go off to a party, which is what I prefer you do. Don't take them to the party. Please don't take your animals to fireworks displays or big parties on July 4th. Again, it's very frightening to them. If possible, you know, seeing how he reacts the first July 4th, I happen to have been blessed. I have had many dogs in my life, and I've never actually seen any of my dogs react too substantially, but I've been at friends' houses and I've watched some animals using today's vernacular, you know, freak out. I mean, become so scared they don't know which way to turn. So I think it's important that we learn our own animal, just like in other circumstances. So the first time July 4th comes around with a new pet, if it's possible, be with them. Be there to comfort them. Be there and know how they react. If you are blessed with an animal that doesn't get really frightened, then obviously in future years, you know, you can go out, just again, make sure they're well contained in a safe area, and they're not going to get hurt. I wouldn't leave them in a backyard because you never know what your neighbors might be doing that night that they didn't do the night before. All of those issues are things to be considered. Other precautions to take, again, if you're doing the fireworks at your house and your pet's inside or out in the backyard, which I hope he wouldn't be, we have to realize that, you know, we can tell a child, we can tell each other and our friends, hey, that fuse is lit, stay away from it. But the dog doesn't understand that, and their nature may be to run to it, not knowing that what's going to happen next. So, again, rule of thumb, they shouldn't be anywhere near. Fireworks and pets don't mix. We're not helping them. We're not helping ourselves. They should be in the house, well protected and cared for and comforted.
Obviously, none of us want to be Scrooges, but let's talk about, let's say, a dog or a cat in the house. You know, your friends are over, and this is going to be happening with great people. You know, the 4th of July is a time of celebration, and they will be in the backyard doing these things. What's the best way to help your dog live through that? What's the best way to constrain them, or how should they be placed, or what can we do in those situations?
Well, first and foremost, how we act will play a direct part in how the animal's going to react. If we're jumping around screaming and yelling and getting upset or getting frightened or having a great time but acting in a fashion which they don't understand, that will parlay into their behavior. That will affect their behavior. So staying calm, comforting is important. Making sure they're in a safe environment so that if they do get scared, they're not going to suddenly run off a cliff or run into an area which could be harmful, run into the street, run behind the television or the laundry machine where they could get hurt. So make sure they're in a safe, protective environment and that our behavior is such that they can be comforted. Another offshoot to this, Sydney, that I think is worth mentioning, every once in a while we run into that individual that, you know, I'd have to say at best is a bit callous. In other words, they're not thinking about the animal's well-being and sometimes actually hurtful. And we may see acts where individuals are throwing firecrackers or fireworks in the animal's direction. Mm. Well, obviously, that should never be thought of as, oh, that's just a young boy acting out. That's actually a behavior that needs to be stopped. If you happen to know of people, I hope people listening to this wonderful broadcast know that they can go to their local Humane Society or Animal Control Agency and report that behavior, and they will investigate it. So obviously, that's just talking about the more negative side of the way people behave around animals. Back to how to protect them, it's again keeping them in a calm, comfortable environment, not anywhere around the fireworks. Sometimes, in rare instances, you may have an animal that behaves in such a fashion that you may want to talk to your veterinarian about whether you should use some tranquilization on July 4th, since those sounds are so apparent. But to me, like any medication or drug, that should be a course of last resort. First, just taking care of them and comforting them and acting well around them is going to go a long way.
Now, let's say that you're outside, you're having fun, and you come in and you find your dog, you know, absolutely terrorized. I mean, they can be seriously psychologically impacted by these things, and they don't know. What is a way to start to help that animal regain their stability?
Well, one preventative piece I'd like to again remind our listeners about is, please make sure, like always, that your dog or cat or animal is properly identified. If the worst happens and they get out of the house or run away, you want to know that they have a collar and a license and an identification tag. Hopefully they've also been microchipped, which is a little electronic device about the size of a piece of rice that goes under their skin and permanently allows them to be identified. So before they act, let's make sure they're properly identified in case the worst happens. If you come in the house, you find them very frightened. Animals respond very well to human touch if they've been socialized, so comforting them, keeping them in a darker room, not in a bright room, is going to help, and redirecting their behavior. That's the night that if you've got a chew toy or some real treat that they just love to play with, often redirecting your friend's behavior, your four-legged or two-legged, or depends, because this applies to birds, it applies to other animals also, redirecting their behavior to something more positive will often take their fear away.
I know I have a cockatiel, for example, and I can't say that this bird has been exposed to 4th of July revelry, but birds in cages, that seems like that could be very dangerous, because when birds get panicked in a cage, they can seriously injure themselves.
Absolutely. That's a great example for us all to learn from, of how an animal, when frightened, can hurt themselves. And where birds are concerned, they go back to that dark space. As you probably know with your cockatiel, if you cover the cage, they calm down. Many animals are going to be individuals. In my case, my dog is crate trained. She thinks of her crate as her den, so that's a place for her to actually go to and feel comfort. We'll direct her attention to that. We'll give her a green bone. We'll give her something to chew on, and she does great. And by the way, a green bone is one of those toys that you can buy in a pet store and buy, you know, in various facilities. They're chew bones.
Let's talk specifically to kids right now. Because, you know, I've been a kid, I've been a guy, I've had lots of fun with sparklers, I've done terrible things with firecrackers. It's part of growing up. Sometimes things happen to kids where they just feel like they really want to tease and taunt animals, and they think it's funny. What can you tell kids about that?
I guess first, in talking to both kids and adults, we have to realize what that behavior is. And I was a little boy, too. And, you know, we've all had our moments.
Are you sure?
Mine was never around animals, but we've all had our moments. And I think we all have to be understanding of each other, but remind each other about compassion. There's a difference between surprising a friend and making an animal frightened. And when we frighten an animal, we have to think about ourselves being frightened. That is a negative feeling that we just don't like. And I think since we get unconditional love, in other words, our animals give us tremendous love and they ask nothing in return, they deserve for us to remember that they are living beings that have feelings, and we don't want to frighten them. Again, talking to both kids and adults, talking to our families, if you know of an individual that kind of just doesn't see this or understand it, please bring it to an adult's attention so that they can take the appropriate action to stop it. You know, today if you're throwing a firecracker at a cat, it's a lot easier to think when you're 20 years old that you might want to hurt a person because you've become a bit more callous. And I think that's a learning lesson. That's one of so many things that animals bring into our life. When we look through their eyes and we interact with them and learn compassion from them, we actually teach each other a compassion about each other.
another aspect of this, too, and you make this point so well, is the fact that these animals are so prepared to love us and be our lifelong friends and bear almost anything, to be our friend. But one bad experience can shatter and destroy that opportunity for the lifetime of that animal.
Well, and that's just one more thing I think we can learn about people. You lose the trust of a person or a friend, and it's very hard to regain it. Animals are actually a lot more forgiving, but you're absolutely correct. One frightening experience may change their behavior. Suddenly, they may not want to go out in the backyard anymore when that's what they used to do. Suddenly, you may be dealing with an animal that's soiling the house because they used to be able to go out for a walk, but the last time they went out for a walk, a big explosion went off. You're absolutely correct. When we lose the trust of another living being, whether it be an animal or a person, it's very hard to get it back, and they truly trust us.
They certainly do. Let's say that someone was out, and let's say it's kids, for example, and maybe some of their friends want to, some of the kids may have an interest in kind of taunting animals. What might you advise them? How can they help deal with that moment? What's the best advice?
Well, I think, first of all, for the sake of the animal, remove yourself from the situation. It's not fair for the animal to be subjected to that type of behavior. The second is, depending on how open and accepting the other person is of saying, hey, you know, it's one of those situations, let's put yourself in their feet, I won't say shoes, and how would you feel if someone threw a sparkler at you or came at you? You know, I know you may not mean to hurt them, but just think of what the animal is feeling, what you would feel if somebody 10 times bigger than you suddenly came at you with this sparkling device or with this, you know, piece of rolled paper that suddenly made a very loud, frightening sound. How would you feel under those circumstances? So we try to relate it. I think I've always made a lot of headway with trying to relate it about how would you feel if you were in their feet. And, to the person that's willing to listen, I think they would understand that. To the person who says, oh, come on, it's just a dog or a cat or a guinea pig or a raccoon, what's the big deal? They're still living creatures. I'm not suggesting we equate them with being the same as people, but they have feelings, they have emotions, they have fears, and they feel pain. And we can't forget that.
We've been talking pretty much about sort of our pets and our animals, but what about as you go into rural areas or even, you know, all it takes is a woods or a forest or some natural areas. How about, what can you tell us about how some of this may affect literally the wild creatures?
It depends. What we also know is that animals, just like people, we compensate for a lot of things in our environment. I used to tell an interesting story. I used to practice in Boston. And when you watch companion animals in cities, if they don't hear the street noises at night, like if suddenly everything stops, they're actually scared because they're used to those noises. Versus a rural environment, if they never hear an ambulance and suddenly one goes by the house, all the animals, you know, kind of react. So a lot has to do when we're talking about wildlife, when we're talking about companion animals or people, what's the standard in the environment? Most likely, many wild animals have probably realized that at some point during the year, obviously they don't understand why it's happening, but sometime during the year, they hear all these loud sounds go off, they probably hunker down, get in a safe place, and hide. Do we have to be sensitive to it? Yes, we do, but we live in a complex world. I think we all have to learn to sort of get along. No different than, you know, people who grew up in the country and certainly hear coyotes howling at night. You know, look at that as a beautiful sound. If you're visiting from the city and it's your first night in the country, it can be pretty fearsome at
first.
That's true. And what we do is we seek out to understand what it is, learn from it, and accept it.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Goldstein, who is the president of the San Diego Humane Society. You know, I'm going to try something here. Let's go 180 degrees. Now, we've talked about some of the things that potentially are dangerous to our animals at this time. What are some ideas on how we can absolutely show these animals that we love them? Some of the best ways for us to really bond, you know, that maybe they go through these experiences. Maybe we need to give back a little bit. What are some fun ideas that way?
Well, Sydney, first, one very positive way to learn some of these things I would point out, and your listening audience I know is very widespread, but for instance, I'm sure there are programs here at the San Diego Humane Society and SPCA. We have something called Animal Adventure Camp. We have a camp every summer for 5 to 14-year-olds. And come to day camp for a week, you'll have a great time, and guess what? You'll also learn a lot of these issues on how to interact with our animals, how to walk up to them safely, how to play with them, what their needs are. So I would encourage both parents and kids out there thinking about programs, whether it's a Saturday program or a camp program, check with your local Humane Society or SPCA, and you may find that there are actually programs that both adults and kids can take part in to learn some of the things we're talking about. Some of the more specific issues, just around this issue, we're talking summer. You know, here we have, you know, some people listening tonight going, you know, we'll go out to the beach and watch the fireworks, and while we're there, we'll make sure the dog's safe, we'll put him in the car. Because first of all, they're not protected from the noise and the sounds. We talked about making sure they're in an environment where they can't hurt themselves. The car, to me, is a strange environment with lots of obstacles in it. And most importantly, a car, even out in a 60-degree day with the sun up, can become a lethal place, can become a very, very dangerous place. So for all of us, you know, listening today, when you go to do something with your animal, to most extent, if you think about what I want this done to me, would I want to be locked up in a car in the sun? No. Then let's not do it to our dogs and cats and birds and guinea pigs and rabbits and all the other wonderful animals in our life. But to be safe around animals and what to make them feel comfortable, you know, realize that we're pretty big to most of our domestic animals when we talk about dogs and cats. You know, when you approach an animal, shrinking your size a little bit so you're not this, I happen to be 6'2", I love animals, and even I forget. I did, in fact, this morning, I approached somebody walking a dog this morning on our campus. And, you know, came right up, knew how to put my hand out, but I forgot that I was a little bit close, and I'm 6'2", and his first look at me was like, who's the jolly giant? So making ourselves a bit smaller, making ourselves a lot less threatening, knowing that they respond to smells and sounds and touch, but first and foremost, to be safe with the animal and ourselves, if you're approaching a strange animal, ask the person with them, is it okay if I play with your animal? Don't assume that every animal can just be touched immediately, any more than we assume each other can be touched without asking permission first. So approaching slowly, taking our time, being positive in our reinforcement with our animals, not yelling at them when they do something bad, but redirecting their behavior and rewarding them for that. All of that goes into making the animals feel more comfortable in our environment.
Now, of course, one of the great services that the Humane Society provides, and that is for lost animals, animals that have run away for whatever reason. And I would guess there's going to be a lot of animals that are going to end up that way. I've witnessed dogs, for example, that have been traumatized, and they just take off terrorized, and they may be miles away before they really even realize. And then also when they're terrorized, very often they're afraid to really show themselves, and so it can be hard to get your animal back. What would be your advice in case your animal happens to be one of those that takes off on a run?
Well, if you've lost your animal, you want to do a couple of things. First of all, realize that somebody should stay in the area where the animal is lost, because many times they actually, just like with lost children, they'll come back to where they were lost. Because they, at that point, realize, hey, this is a pretty scary world out there. I had it pretty good with those guys. I'm going back.
That's great.
So first of all, don't go too far. At least leave someone in the area so that they can be helpful in trying to find the animal. Second of all, you know, widen that scope of looking for him more and more. If you can't find the animal, then obviously letting your neighbors, letting the people at the area location know you're looking for them. When it goes to looking at institutions, I appreciate you giving the credit to humane societies. Some humane societies actually, I'm talking now in the state of California, may have what is called the animal control contract. If they don't, it will actually be your local animal control or animal services facility where a lost animal will show up. If one comes to us here at the Humane Society, we will actually turn a lost animal over to the Department of Animal Services. That makes it much easier for someone to go to only certain places to look for their lost animal. So a lost animal always goes, at least in the state of California, to the local municipal agency, whether it's the Department of Animal Services or the Department of Animal Control or both. Some humane societies have those contracts. So you have to know who your municipal animal welfare association is when looking for a lost animal. Putting up signs, letting the neighbors know, and being patient, keeping yourself calm, all of those help in finding a lost animal.
And then one last thing, too. So you find your animal, but they're scared. And typically, in the past, when you've called them, they've come, but for some reason they're not doing that now. What's the best advice?
Well, first, food is a great positive motivator. You want to go out there looking with some treats in your hand. You know, you don't necessarily want to be swinging a leash around. You, again, want to make yourself look inviting. At this point, you're absolutely right, they're scared. Entering into any emergency situation, and that's what that is at that point, make sure we assess the location. We don't want to walk towards the animal if on the other side of the animal is a highway. So take out, check out the situation. Realize that, you know, half the battle is won if you can see them. Now be calm, be patient, be welcoming, lower yourself down, become small. That is not the time to yell at the animal for getting lost. That's the time for them to feel loved so they come towards you.
Compassion at that point, they perceive. Well, Dr. Mark Goldstein, president of the San Diego Humane Society, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the Wild Side News. And if people want to find out more about the San Diego Humane Society or the Humane Society at the national level, how can they do so?
Well, as far as the San Diego Humane Society and SPCA, and realize that we're all very independent organizations that work together, but we are separate organizations. You can find out a lot about us on our website at www.sd, like in San Diego, so sdhumane.org. Or feel free to give us a call at 619-299-7012. You can reach us that way and learn more about us. You know, there are other national organizations that you can go on the web. If you just put in Humane Societies or Animal Welfare Associations, you'll find out about them. And I ask that people listening support their local Humane Society or SPCA. Learn who they are, learn how to work with them, and if people are interested, I'm sure any one of us love volunteers, so also think of that if you want to learn about animals, and come down and spend some time with us.
Dr. Mark Goldstein, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on the Wild Side News.
Great, and we thank everybody for listening. It's a great show that you have, and thank you for your support, Sydney.
You bet, anytime.
Have a safe and fun 4th, and please, be kind to our animals. When we return, we go in-depth with an analysis of our new national energy bill passed this week in the Senate. We hear the perspective of a representative from REP, REP, that's Republicans for the Environment, when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Two halves of an energy bill were completed this week when the U.S. Senate passed their side of the national energy bill. With oil prices reaching now into the $60 per barrel strata, and China making moves to do a cash buyout of one of America's leading oil companies, the need for a comprehensive energy policy has reached critical levels. In the spirit of the bipartisan nature of the Senate bill, you are about to go in-depth with a spokesman for Republicans for the Environment. That's coming up in just a moment on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. As America celebrates its birthday, and we celebrate our freedom and democracy, the meaning of such is now facing some of its most serious tests as the very foundation of our economic and global survival slip and slide on the oil politics now playing out around the world. This week, the Senate passed Senate Bill 6, our national energy bill, by an 87-12 vote, showing a bipartisan commitment to getting this done. There's much left to making this a law. To explore this legislation, we take a special in-depth analysis of this bill and the future of America's energy policy.
This last Tuesday, the Senate finally passed something they've been trying to do for quite some time, and they passed a national energy bill for America. And joining us to talk about what this means is Jim DePeso, who is the policy director for REP, which stands for Republicans for Environmental Protection. Jim, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Good to be with you, Sydney.
Why don't you tell us about REP so that our listeners can understand your perspective?
We're a grassroots organization of ordinary citizens. In fact, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. We came together 10 years ago because we were concerned that the leadership within the Republican Party in Congress at the time was abandoning our Republican Party's older conservation traditions, you know, the heritage that was left behind by Theodore Roosevelt and other Republican leaders of the past, and we were concerned about that. We felt that this is an issue that the Republican Party needs to be a positive leader on, that needs to make positive contributions towards solving today's environmental and conservation problems, and needs to take these issues seriously. So we've come together to push our Republican leaders to take environmental issues seriously, to acknowledge what the scientists are telling us about the environmental changes taking place in our country and around the world, and to come forward with positive solutions that will address those issues, and not to turn them into political footballs.
Standard belief is that the liberal side represents more environment and the Republican side represents more economics, but with $60 per barrel oil, all of a sudden economics and environment are definitely related.
And they always have been. It's just that with $60 a barrel oil prices, that relationship becomes much more immediately obvious. What we've been saying all along is that good, strong environmental policies are good for the economy, and a strong economy is good for the environment. There's two sides of the same proposition, and for too long, many of the debates that we've been seeing and hearing in Washington, D.C. have treated the environment and the economy as two separate things that usually are opposed to each other, and that's just false thinking, and we think that there needs to be much more focus on finding those intelligent solutions that will allow us to achieve our economic and environmental objectives in our country.
Possibly it's a good thing that at this point we're being forced to really address these issues. It's sad that we have to do it in this way, but here we go. Well, let's take a look at the Senate energy bill. And first of all, why don't we talk about some of the things that you think are positive?
Okay, there are a few things. Unlike the House bill, which was passed in April, the Senate bill is a better deal for the American people. There's still quite a bit that's wrong with it. But let me answer your question by talking about some of the good things that are in the Senate bill. Number one, the Senate passed what's called a renewable portfolio standard. And basically what that is, it is a requirement that utilities and electricity providers must have at least 10% of the electricity that they sell has to be obtained from renewable energy resources, things like wind turbines, solar power plants, geothermal plants, biofuels, and later on, ocean wave energy and ocean tidal energy as well. And this 10% requirement would phase in and would kick in by 2020. So 15 years from now, utilities would have to obtain at least 10% of the electricity that they sell from renewable energy resources. So that's a good thing, and that would help build the market for renewable energy resources, and the bigger the market that exists for these types of technologies, the more we can drive the prices down. And there are a lot of ancillary benefits to these resources in addition to their environmental benefits. Obviously, wind and solar plants don't cause air pollution or release greenhouse gas emissions. But a more hard-nosed green eyeshade benefit is that they help insulate us a bit from price spikes and price variability in the cost of fuel, chiefly natural gas. And natural gas can be very volatile in terms of prices, and the more electricity that we obtain from wind energy, the less vulnerable we are to those types of price spikes. So that's a good thing. Another good thing that the Senate did, and this is very modest, it doesn't go as far as we think it should have, but the Senate did pass a resolution, it's what they call a sense of the Senate resolution, that greenhouse gas emissions are changing our climate, that human activities are responsible for a significant share of those greenhouse gas emissions, and that at some point Congress should adopt a mandatory market-based system of limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Now, for those of us who have been working in this field, the environmental field, for some time, it's not much. It's just a resolution. It's just a statement of belief. But when you consider how, you know, twisted politics can get in Washington, D.C., for the United States Senate, a majority of the U.S. Senate, to stand up and say, yes, this problem is real, and, you know, at some point we have to deal with it. You know, for Washington, D.C., that is, you know, that is noteworthy. You know, many of the members of Congress for too long have, and the administration for that matter, have not taken this issue seriously, and there are, you know, more than a few members of Congress who are just in outright denial about the problem. This is a good thing. It's not far enough, not strong enough, but, you know, it's a good first step.
Mm-hmm. What else do you think is good?
Both the Senate and the House bills have packages of tax incentives that are part of the deal. The reason why the Senate version is a better package is that it's better balanced. About 40% of the package is for what we call clean energy technology. Energy efficiency technologies and renewable energy technology development as well. The House version, on the other hand, is very heavily weighted towards just conventional, you know, oil and gas subsidies. And even the president himself has said that with the oil at $60 a barrel, the oil industry really does not need the help of the taxpayers in funding research on better oil extraction technologies. They can afford to pay for that sort of research themselves. In terms of the, you know, tax incentive package, the Senate version is a much better deal for the taxpayers and for, you know, for the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. How about some of the ethanol incentives that have been placed in this bill as well?
Well, I think that, you know, ethanol has it's gotten something of a bad rap over the last few years. That you know, there is concern that the energy that goes into producing ethanol doesn't yield as much energy as comes out of the end product. That we're using farmland and corn that could be used for feeding people to produce fuel. But ultimately, we have to look at a bigger picture with ethanol. Over time, we want to get to the point where we are using a much broader array of plant materials to produce ethanol. Right now we use corn because it's easier to produce ethanol from the starch in the corn. But that is a very small feedstock. Ultimately, the point we would like to get at is where we use low-grade or even, you know, worthless, what are now considered worthless plant materials to actually serve as the feedstock to produce ethanol. And, you know, that would be things like fast-growing grasses or crop waste or other materials that right now just have no economic value. So it's important that we continue to support ethanol production and expand it. So when we get to that point where we produce that what's called cellulosic ethanol from those low-grade plant materials, we'll have, number one, a much bigger supply of biofuels that we can use to replace gasoline and to reduce our dependence on oil. Two, it would give our rural communities and farmers a market for, you know, plant materials that right now have no market or no value. And three, it would reduce pressure on corn production so that, you know, corn could be used for, you know, foodstuffs and, you know, not diverted to fuel production. So, that's a good thing. We think that, adding more ethanol to our mix of motor vehicle fuels overall is good because it, one, reduces our dependence on oil, two, provides economic opportunities for our rural communities, and three, we can, you know, reduce our greenhouse gas and pollution emissions by using more biofuels in place of petroleum-based fuels.
Woolsey has recently put out some figures, too, that when you start combining a serious mix of ethanol and gasoline with hybrid vehicles, It can ultimately translate potentially out to 400 miles per gallon in a much more highly clean tech form, and that's kind of exciting too. And apparently these technologies are not all that far off.
No, they're not. There is research going on now to produce these cellulosic ethanols,
right. Mm-hmm.
from plant cellulose and other low grade plant materials. In fact, there is a plant that has been built recently in Idaho that will be producing this stuff. But yeah, the figures that Jim Woolsey has produced are quite exciting. When
mm-hmm.
you combine biofuels, you know, ethanol with plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, then you could potentially get 500 miles per gallon of gasoline. And his group has estimated that we could, by 2025, 20 years from now, we could reduce our petroleum demand by something on the order of 12 million barrels a day. Now, when you consider that right now we're using 21 million barrels a day, nearly 60% of which is imported, that is very significant. That would really reduce our dependence on oil and would really reduce the the dangerous exposures that we face as a result of our dependence on a very volatile, brittle global oil market. As you can see, with prices spiking and with the market being as tight as it is, we are exposing our economy and our security to some serious dangers by continuing to be heavily dependent on oil as we are today.
Well, that cat is under the bag right now, and it's forcing us to take some very serious looks at these future issues. One other aspect of the hybrid ethanol discussion is that whereas, for example, hydrogen per se is something that certainly has a terrific amount of future in terms of providing energy in a clean form, the way in which it's distributed is not common right now, whereas the ethanol mix, it's a process of just literally transferring this mixture into our existing systems, and so it's much more easily, we can move into that system much more easily than others.
Yeah, that's an important point that Jim Woolsey and his group are making, is that, hydrogen is great, and, we should continue to, pursue that line of research and develop, hydrogen-based motor vehicle technologies. But right now, there are several million cars on the road today, and, many of the owners may not even be aware of this, who can put ethanol into their gas tanks today. They can put either ethanol or gasoline or any combination of the two right into their tank today, and their cars have a little switch inside the engine that tells the engine that it's dealing with either ethanol or gasoline or a mixture of the two. These are called flexible fuel vehicles. Mm-hmm. There's about 3 million of them on the road today. And most of these vehicles are fueled almost exclusively with gasoline, because except for Minnesota, there just isn't all that many places available where you can fill up with ethanol. Minnesota is the exception, because the state of Minnesota has made it a deliberate public policy to expand the use of ethanol as a fuel, and that's obviously because they want to support their corn farmers. So they have state policies in place that have encouraged the growth of ethanol fueling stations. So if you drive one of these flexible fuel vehicles in Minnesota, you can probably find ethanol to put into the thing. Now, another exciting development is biodiesel. I was just reading the local daily newspaper here in the Seattle area that biodiesel has become sort of the hip thing among new car buyers around here. What's interesting is that Volkswagen has provided that the diesel cars that it sells, the warranties for those cars will cover the use of biodiesel in those cars. So, in other words, if you put biodiesel in a Volkswagen diesel car, it's not going to kill your warranty. So that has really helped expand the market for biodiesel. So people up here are snapping these Volkswagen cars right off the lots, and they're filling them up with biodiesel that a number of local vendors here have made available. And right now, biodiesel is about $3 a gallon, which is a little higher than petroleum-based diesel. But for a lot of folks, the idea of putting a clean farm-based fuel into their cars that does not come from Saudi Arabia is something to be rather proud of. So there's, for a number of these folks who have bought these cars, it's worth it to pay a little extra for the biodiesel.
It's interesting that the fact that these things are actually finding their way into our society. They're becoming available, and I suppose from my perspective, one of the downsides of the energy bill was the fact that it really didn't prioritize these new developments to the degree that I had hoped. And let's also talk about some of the things that you feel were failures in the bill.
Well, in the Senate bill, probably the number one failure in both the Senate and the House energy bill is the failure to update and strengthen the motor vehicle fuel economy standards that have been on the books since the mid-1970s. The fuel economy standards that we have right now are, if you average it out between cars and light trucks, are about 24 miles per gallon, and it's largely been that way since the 1980s. Right now, we have the technologies. That's nothing exotic, nothing that has to be invented 20 years from now, but technologies that exist today or will in the very near future to significantly improve motor vehicle fuel economy. And it's not just, you know, it's not just hybrid electric vehicles. It's just a series of things that can be done under the hood with the engines and the transmissions of motor vehicles to significantly improve their fuel economy. And this has been documented by a number of independent studies by the National Academy of Sciences and a number of other groups of experts who have looked into this issue and have estimated that we could probably improve fuel economy, 10 to 15%, by applying these technologies and phasing in tougher fuel standards. And if we were to do that, that would significantly reduce our dependence on oil, reduce our exposure to the dangers of the global oil market, and of course have a number of environmental benefits as well, chiefly the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. That was the biggest failing. The Senate, both the Senate and the House are still falling short when it comes to acknowledging that we have to address the demand side of the equation as well as the supply side of the equation in solving our country's energy problems.
You are very knowledgeable in this. What do you think is the reason that these CAFE standards have had such a have been so contentious, and here we are still struggling with this?
Well, I think it's just basic DC politics, where you have the automakers, and chiefly the culprits here are the American automakers, and the to a lesser extent, but no less, but still significant, the United Auto Workers as well. There, political pressure that the Detroit and the unions are exerting to prevent the updating of these fuel economy standards, because their argument is that, well, if you force us to do this, we won't be able to produce the types of vehicles that Americans want to buy, and that means reduced demand for our vehicles, lost jobs. Detroit is going to lose even more money than it's losing now, and it's just bad for the economy. Well, those arguments just don't hold water. The automakers can produce vehicles that are more fuel efficient as well as desirable and safe vehicles. And again, the studies I alluded to earlier show that this is possible. I think what we're dealing with here is just a little bit of stubbornness on the part of the automakers, who they just don't like being told what to do. And this goes back many years. They didn't like being told they had to put seat belts in cars. They didn't like being told that they had to put in airbags and other passive safety features. They didn't like being told they had to clean up their tailpipe emissions, and they didn't like being told to improve their fuel economy, 30 years ago when these CAFE standards were first adopted. But, the counter argument is, well, you may not like being told, but there's we have a national strategic interest in reducing our dependence on oil. Our dependence on oil is dangerous to our nation's security. It exposes our economy to all sorts of stresses and dangers. And in addition to the environmental downsides, there is a strong national interest in improving fuel economy, and that fully justifies telling the automakers that they have to meet these standards, which are both economical and technically feasible to meet.
I think that's part of the new dynamic is prioritizing to what degree we should base our legislation on reactive, that is to say, the crises and reacting to those crises, versus proactive. If we could change the priority to thinking much more in terms of proactive legislation and technologies, we would, well, if we don't do that, we're going to be in a very difficult position. Had we done this 20, 30 years ago when these issues were brought up, we'd be flying high right now. We'd be in good shape,
Well, I agree with that, because I still remember my oldest and best friend, who I'm still in touch with, 30 years ago, we were in a high school debating class, and as part of the debating team, we chose energy as the topic.
Interesting.
And both of us kept our notes, and those notes are like 30 years old, and we've gone, just for fun, we've gone back over those notes, and 30 years ago, we were talking about largely the same issues, the same concerns, and making the same proposals that, this country needs to approach energy, strategically, and deal with making sure that we use it efficiently and diversify, don't put all of our energy eggs into too few baskets. And we're still arguing the same issues. And had we, taken those steps 30 years ago, you're right, had we taken those steps 30 years ago or even 20 years ago, we'd be a lot better off than we are today. But that's, that's water under the bridge right now.
Well,
and what we need to do today is, again, think of energy as think of it in strategic terms, and figure out an energy policy that will improve our country's security, that will improve our economy and leave it less exposed to various stresses and dangers, and make sure that we are reducing the size of our environmental footprint.
If there are other things that you feel were failures, let's discuss those, and then we'll kind of see what this all means.
Well, yeah, and I think when it comes to failure, I think the House Energy Bill is the one that really needs to have the some blame pinned on it. It's well deserving of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
The House Energy Bill would just simply tie our future to oil as the basis of our energy policy and our energy economy, and that is a just foolish and dangerous policy. There are a couple of reasons why. Number one, as we have seen, the oil market is very tight right now. Even the Saudi Arabians, the big kahunas among all the oil exporters, are having a hard time keeping up their production to meet the growing demand. And there are more than a few experts who are concerned that global production of conventional oil may have or is close to reaching a peak, the maximum peak that it's possible to produce. And in the face of rising demand, that is a prescription for ever higher prices and more price volatility. There are a number of energy experts who have been writing some interesting books that have been published recently that explain this peak oil phenomenon very clearly. So that's a concern also. The second concern, of course, is the rising greenhouse gas emissions and the ever-growing scientific consensus that climate change is a serious issue, or our activities are responsible for a great share of this accumulated greenhouse gas buildup. But the House Energy Bill just simply dismisses all of that and ties our country's future to oil and continues to shower subsidies on the oil industry, which clearly does not need it at a time of $60 a barrel oil prices. So that is probably one of the most egregious failures, is that there is too much focus on increasing conventional supplies of conventional energy sources, and not enough attention being paid to making our energy use more efficient and to diversifying the energy technologies that we use in this country, so we don't have all of our eggs in the oil basket.
Well, certainly, from my perspective, a new development that really is, it's controversial, and that is the fact that Senator Domenici really brought forth support for new developments in the nuclear industry.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Rep, we have kind of an ambiguous position on nuclear energy. There are very serious issues with nuclear energy development. The waste issue still has not been solved to everyone's satisfaction. At some point we're going to have to find a place to put the waste that has already been produced as a result of using nuclear fission energy for electricity production. So that issue needs to be resolved in a way that truly ensures that the waste will stay isolated from the environment for very, very long periods of time. The federal government just hasn't gotten to that point yet. The second concern, of course, is that nuclear energy is a high-cost energy resource, and one of the reasons why nuclear fell on hard times over the last 20 years is that investors were just unwilling to tie up their money in a very capital-intensive form of energy production that takes a long time to come online. So if you're an investor and you're looking at a very capital-intensive power plant that may not be online for another 10 to 15 years, you're not sure you want to put your money at that kind of a risk. And so that's another reason that nuclear development hit the skids. And thirdly, the way we've developed nuclear energy in this country really just was not very smart. Unlike France, for example, all of the nuclear power plants in this country, to a great extent, are custom designed, which means if you have a problem or a technical issue with one and you fix it at one plant, you can't take that what you learned there and apply it to other plants because they have different sorts of designs and engineering designs. So that has led to needlessly higher costs and reliability issues as well. Whereas if we had more standardized designs for these plants, if you learn, if you resolve a technical issue at one plant, you can apply that at others and thereby reduce costs overall. Now, having said all that, we're not willing to say we should just close the door to further nuclear power development in this country. And the number one reason why we're unwilling to take nuclear off the table is that with the greenhouse gas emissions becoming such a significant issue, with the science clearly showing that we need to take action and take action fast to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The concern is that if you take a big baseload power source off the table, and by baseload I mean a power plant that produces steady amounts of power 24 hours a day and is the foundation of the electric power system and the grid we have in this country, then you're going to be seeing a lot more coal being burned. And if we cannot figure out ways of sequestering the carbon dioxide that coal-fired power plants produce and storing it underground reliably so we can be sure once it's put under there it stays there, then that could be very serious. Coal is cheap. We make use of it through very well understood technologies. Coal-fired power plants can be built and relatively easily. There isn't a lot of new engineering or new technical issues that you have to overcome to build a coal-fired power plant. If coal becomes the default easy choice, then we're looking at some very, very significant issues in terms of getting a handle on this greenhouse gas problem. So our position on nuclear is complicated and somewhat ambiguous, but I think if we had to boil it down, we would say that we probably ought to be looking at some of these advanced nuclear technologies. For example, there's a type of reactor called a pebble bed that is designed quite a bit differently from the conventional light water reactors that we use in this country today. That according to the scientists who have been designing these types of plants, there are fewer safety issues, less chance of things going wrong. And it might be possible to build these things in a modular way that would reduce costs. So we do think that we do need to look into that. But as I said, the waste and the economic issues are real and they're serious, and they do need to be resolved if there's ever going to be even a mini renaissance of nuclear energy in this country.
We're talking with Jim DePeso, who is the policy director for REP, Republicans for Environmental Protection America. That's kind of an overview, a nice summary of elements of the bill. Now let's ask the tough question, and that is let's start with sort of a concept of, on a scale of 1 to 10, to what degree has the Senate bill addressed our oil future from your perspective?
On a 1 to 10 scale where 10 is good and 1 is bad, I would say I'd give them about maybe a 4 or a 5.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I'd give the House bill maybe a 1 or a 2.
Mm-hmm.
If they would just put in those tougher fuel economy standards, update those CAFE standards, I'd give them a much higher grade.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just still shying away from that, and that is the single most important thing we could do right now to reduce our dependence on oil.
Now, of course, because the Senate has passed this, does not mean that there's a law. This has to go back to the House, and then the fight begins again.
Well, what happens is that the Senate and the House are going to appoint what's called a conference committee, where members of the House and of the Senate will sit together in one committee and try to come to an agreement on a bill, because a bill cannot become law unless both the House and the Senate pass identical versions that are identical right down to the last comma. And then it's only then is it presented to the president for his signature or veto, as the case may be. And there are some serious differences between the Senate and the House versions of the bill that raise serious questions as to whether they can come up with a uniform compromise bill by the August recess, for Congress's August recess. That's the goal, which is to put a bill on the president's desk by the first part of August. But there's some real questions as to whether they can do that, because there are some serious differences between what the Senate energy bill says and the House bill as well. A couple of the differences, of course, one is the renewable energy standard I alluded to earlier. The Senate bill includes that. The House bill does not. Another is liability for producers of MTBE. That's a gasoline additive. And, many of your listeners in California know full well what that means. The MTBE is a gasoline additive that leaked out of underground storage tanks and polluted drinking water supplies, and not just in California, but in many places across the country. And that is going to be serious. The House bill includes liability protection for MTBE producers. The Senate bill does not. That will be a very serious bone of contention.
And, of course, that's what killed this potential bill 2 years ago.
Well, that's right. That was one of the serious issues that killed the energy bill in 2003. Another point of contention where, ironically, the House could be the, quote, environmental champion as opposed to the Senate. The Senate bill includes a provision to do an inventory of oil and gas resources off our coast.
That, I think, is a sleeping monster.
The sleeping monster. Now, the House bill does not include provisions for that inventory, and the reason for that is it goes right back to our Constitution, where the membership of the House is proportioned on the basis of population, and in the Senate, of course, each state has equal representation. The very large California and Florida delegations, both Republicans and Democrats in both states, really are not interested in seeing the camel's nose of offshore oil drilling being inserted into the energy bill. So if these very large delegations in those two states in the House could put a crimp in any efforts by the Senate to get that offshore oil drilling inventory included in the compromise energy bill that may or may not come out of the conference committee this summer.
So let's go back to that 1 to 10 scale. What do you think the chances are that there will be compromise and that a law will be passed?
I think I'm going to give it about a 6 or a 7.
Oh, that's pretty high, actually.
Although there are differences, mm-hmm. I think there's also a lot of political pressure from being exerted within the Congress and from the administration to get something on the president's desk so that they can go back to their constituents and say, well, we did something. With $60 a barrel oil prices, with natural gas prices also rising, which is sort of getting second billing in the energy drama, but it's no less of a real problem, that they want to be able to tell their constituents as the 2006 elections approach that, well, we did something about energy. But even the proponents of the legislation, at least in their more honest moments, will admit that the contents of the bill, of the energy legislation, really is not going to have much of an immediate impact on the energy prices, even if the policies that they include in those bills do everything that they say they will. The system or the problem is very complicated. It's very deep rooted. You can't expect one piece of legislation to magically cause the price of oil to go down to $30 a barrel. That's just not going to happen.
That was my next question. To what degree, it's pretty obvious, but I'll ask it anyway. To what degree, and you've just stated it, to what degree do you think this might have any impact or influence on our current crisis in energy pricing?
In the near term, very little, because the prices are being driven by very large, deep-rooted supply and demand factors. You have global demand for oil rising, demand rising in the United States, rising in China and other large countries. And then you have the production capability that is just stretched to the max. It's not just the oil wells that are stretched to the max. The whole oil supply chain is at about capacity, and that includes tankers, that includes offshore drilling rigs, that includes pipelines, just the availability of skilled labor. A lot of the skilled labor that the oil industry has relied on for many years is they're getting old. They're getting long in the tooth. And with all due apologies to any roughnecks out there who may be listening, a lot of the engineering talent and the other specialized talent that the oil industry relies on is they're not getting any younger, and the whole oil supply chain is just stretched to the max. A really good book that I think your listeners may, if they really want to delve into this, a really good book that explains this is just was published. It's called Twilight in the Desert by Matthew Simmons. Matthew Simmons is an energy investment banker from Houston, and he spent quite a bit of time analyzing the Saudi Arabia's oil fields. And he has come to the interesting and, if true, very alarming conclusion that the purported vast size of the Saudi Arabian oil fields are not as vast as they've been made out to be, and that there are very serious signs that the Saudis may have peaked out their conventional oil production. There's a lot of water being produced from those oil fields, and that's a telltale sign that those Saudi oil fields have been overdrawn and may even have been damaged.
Wouldn't that be a kick in the head if that turned out to be true?
If that turns out to be true, that would be, because Saudi Arabia still is the linchpin of the global oil market. They have the biggest production capacity, and the purported size of their reserves gives them disproportionate influence over the global oil market. If it comes to the point where Saudi Arabia cannot keep up with the rising demand, well, nobody else can either, and that is nothing more than the prescription for price volatility and continuing increases in oil prices. So that would be very serious. So I would recommend that. I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but it is just out, and Matthew Simmons is very well regarded in the oil business. So these are not the ravings of some crank. This is a guy who's been in the business for many years. He knows what he's talking about. And if he has come to this conclusion, it's definitely something we need to take seriously.
This is Jim DePesso, who is the policy director for REP, the Republicans for Environmental Protection. You know, the danger in that, Jim, is that if enough people read that and it reaches a critical mass in terms of belief, $100 per barrel oil could happen very soon.
Well, that's right, because with the oil market being as drum tight as it is right now, any little thing that causes the market to be disrupted could lead to dramatic increases in prices over a very short period of time. Even Goldman Sachs is an investment banking firm located in New York, very large national investment banking firm, and they have studied this issue and have concluded that $100 a barrel oil prices is just not out of the question.
Jim,
if you were to have a major upset in the oil supply chain, let's say you have a bombing, if you will, in one of the Saudi Arabian production facilities, or you have some sort of civil unrest in Nigeria or Venezuela or other oil-producing regions, any upset in the market like that could lead to the sort of panicky type behavior that we saw in the 1970s when people started lining up I remember those gas lines too. And that sort of behavior could easily occur if the oil market is upset by some major event, like major disruption, like I just mentioned.
Jim, have you had the time to really think about what that would mean, how in the world this this economy and our society and culture would survive that?
Well, it would be very serious, because let's sit down and let's really think through how dependent we are on oil. I mean, it's not just our transportation that moves people to and from work, that moves food from farm to supermarket, that moves manufactured goods from the production plant to the point of final sale. It is our very food production process itself is dependent on oil for the chemicals, the agricultural equipment that depends on oil. Our pharmaceutical industries, many of the medications and drugs that are produced are based on petrochemical feedstocks. It's just our dependence on oil is pervasive. And if nobody is saying that we're about to run out of oil, that's not credible. But what is credible is the argument that the days of cheap oil may be behind us. When you consider the rising demand for oil by the United States and other countries, and when you consider that the production system may be about tapped out. There was another interesting report that was published. So, to answer your question, this would be very serious as in terms of how we would manage. We would have to, there's a couple of things that could happen. We could react the wrong way and undertake a crash program to develop, liquid hydrocarbons to replace the oil. And by that, I mean developing tar sands and oil shale and various heavy oils that are available in abundance but are very difficult to produce and are very energy intensive to turn into something that's refinable into motor gasoline.
And even that would take quite a bit of time.
It would take some time. There was a report that was published by a consulting firm on behalf of the Department of Energy that looked into this very question. Could we ramp up production of these unconventional hydrocarbons in time to meet some sort of old conventional oil crisis? And the answer was no. It would take 10 to 20 years, even if you undertake a crash program, to produce oil from shale in the Rockies or Canadian tar. Well, the Canadians are already producing tar sands, but there are tar sands available in Utah and elsewhere in the Central Rockies, and to produce more heavy oil from Venezuela, which has these very heavy oils in abundance. The problem with these heavy oils is that it's like tar. It's very expensive to lift it up out of the ground, and then you have to chemically alter it to make it, you know, refinable into gasoline, and that in and of itself is an energy-intensive process.
The unfortunate side of this is the fact that it could happen soon, and that is just the rise in the price of oil. I don't know how we're supposed to deal with that. And, you know, the Saudi Arabian prince or king or someone becomes ill, and the next thing you know, the price of oil starts to fluctuate. These are extremely sensitive times right now.
They are. The market is like, the way I try to explain this to people is like you take a pencil and balance it on the underside of your index finger and just try to balance it. Mm-hmm. And all you got to do is tap one end of the pencil just a little bit, and the pencil falls off your finger onto the ground.
Yeah.
That's somewhat akin to the way the oil market is behaving right now. It's very finely balanced between supply and demand, and any upset that would cause a reduction in supply, whether it's a bombing in the Middle East or some civil unrest in other exporting nations, could cause the market to behave very erratically and cause prices to spike up very dramatically. Because we saw what happened in the 1970s when the oil market was tightened up as a result of the OPEC Arab oil embargo. The on the demand side, consumers started behaving in a, well, I don't want to say panicky, but people became very concerned. And most of the time, people drive around with a half or less, with their gas tanks half full or even less than half full. Well, in the 1970s, people became concerned, well, there isn't going to be any enough gasoline, so I got to keep my gasoline tank topped off at all times. That caused a disruption in the market because the market is structured in such a way that the retail market is structured in such a way that the retailers don't really count on having to supply enough gasoline to help people keep their tanks topped off at all times. So when that happened, when people panicked and decided that they had to keep their gasoline tanks topped off, you saw the gasoline lines, you saw the gas shortages, you saw the odd and even rationing. Everybody who came of age in the 1970s well remembers all of that. And that was a reaction to the psychology of the market.
Now, here's a question for a Republican for the environment that is, we're all talking about globalization and markets and the internationalization of capitalism and things of that nature, but now we have China has made a very serious offer to buy an American, our ninth largest American oil company, Unocal.
Right.
How does a Republican respond to that at this time?
Well, at this time, the federal government is really in a pickle over this issue because, personally, I think that if the Chinese oil company makes a fair bid for Unocal, and if the stockholders of Unocal believe that it's a fair bid and decide that that's the way they want to go, then by all means they should be allowed to sell out to the Chinese oil company.
I mean, this has been happening from our perspective. We've been buying companies all over the world for a very long time.
Well, yeah, and in many, in a globalized economy, which is here to stay, that companies are bought and sold all the time by foreign operators, whether it's Americans buying companies overseas or companies from other countries buying U.S. companies. So this happens all the time. So I think if the Chinese bid is a fair bid and the stockholders of Unocal want to accept that offer, then who are we to say that they can't do that? The reason why that the federal government is in a pickle is because of all the political implications. Is that they don't like the idea of a Chinese oil company buying an American oil company, but at the same time, for a lot of reasons, they don't want to get the Chinese upset because, number one, China is our banker now, whether people know that or not. All of the debt that is being issued to support our budget deficit, a lot of those bonds are being bought by the Chinese, and they have their own reasons for buying them. They want to support their currency and a number of other reasons, but for all intents and purposes, China is now our banker. And as those of you who hold a mortgage know, you don't want to do anything that upsets your banker. So even though the Bush administration and members of Congress are upset about this, they don't want to get the Chinese upset for for that reason I just mentioned. And another reason, of course, is all the diplomacy and issues involved with figuring out what to do about North Korea and its nuclear dabbling. So, you know, China will have a significant role to play in figuring that problem out. And again, if we get the Chinese upset at us, our, you know, strategies for dealing with North Korea may come to naught. So it's a very ticklish political issue. It's very hard to look at it as an economic issue in isolation.
Has there ever been a more complex time in your lifetime?
No, I can safely say that I'm 50 years old. I just turned 50 this year, and I cannot recall any time that has been as complicated and with so many huge issues at stake. We have so many big issues that we have to get right and get right very soon. There's the whole climate change issue. There's the energy policy issues that we've spent a fair amount of time discussing this afternoon. There's a whole host of interrelated global development, global health, and, you know, international trade issues that have to be dealt with intelligently, very quickly, and very and we don't have much time to waste, and we have to get it right the first time. So, you know, as the old Chinese proverb says, these are interesting times, and like I say, we're going to have to get a lot of things right and do it quickly, and it leaves me, you know, fairly concerned that you know, the next, you know, 20 to 50 years could be, we could be in for some rough times. I don't know. I don't want to conclude on a pessimistic note, because, you know, it is possible that, you know, for reasons that we don't know of, or for because of changing circumstances we can't conceive of right now, we will get these decisions right. But it might be a close call, too.
I really believe it's going to require whole new levels of leadership on this planet that are transformational. I don't know how else to address it. The key phrase that you used was intelligently address these issues, and I think that is what we need to do now, is to kind of put politics and other concerns, issues aside, and interests really, and start to really realize that for life to survive on this planet, and for people and families and cultures and civilizations, we're going to have to do something different. I don't have an answer. I'm not proposing what that is. Mm-hmm. But I do believe somehow there has to be a whole new leadership that emerges that begins to work cooperatively to resolve these things.
Yeah, I go back to a saying that you know, Abraham Lincoln made at the height of the Civil War, when you know, when our country was facing just unprecedented circumstances, and he said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." Again, the wisdom of Abraham Lincoln resounds through the ages, and that statement right there puts it all into perspective. We really do have to you know, try some new things, and the leadership of today's generation has to rise to the occasion and get a lot of things right and get them right quickly.
Well, Jim DePeso, who is the policy director for REP, Republicans for Environmental Protection, I want to thank you so much. I hope we can continue our discussions into the future here, and hopefully we'll have some great things to talk about before we have to talk about too many more negative things.
I'd be happy to talk with you anytime, Sidney. Just give me a call, and I'd be happy to come on to your program.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Perhaps this 4th of July, while we join our friends outdoors in the spirit of American freedom, take a few moments to think about it, really, and about what we need to do to keep this party going for a long, long time. So, have a great 4th of July. We'll get together again next Thursday, or any time on the archives, as your voice of the earth keeps speaking truth to wonder here on the Wild Side News.